landscape of differences and disagreements, we have the opportunity to create something new. At a minimum, we learn more about each other than before. Ideally, we may find new possibilities that had not even been considered before. Conflict transformation is about creating deeper understanding. It requires perspective taking. As a result, it enables greater connection, whether or not there is agreement. For our last question, I told Dr. Buck that I spend a lot of my time preparing my argument when other people are talking. I want to be ready to counter. Yet I hate it when people do that to me. I can tell when someone's not listening. It feels terrible. I asked her, how can I slow things down in the midst of conflict? Dr. Buck replied, one of the most essential steps in this transformative communication, and perhaps the most courageous, is not only to be open-minded, but to listen with desire to learn more about the other person's perspective. She said, I believe and tell my students, one of the most courageous things to say in an uncomfortable conversation is, tell me more. Exactly when we want to turn away and change the topic or just end the conversation or counter, as I said, we also have the opportunity to ask what else we need to know to fully understand the other person's perspective. Help me understand why this is so important to you. Or help me understand why you don't agree with this particular idea. Then we have to listen. Really listen. Listen to understand. Not about agreeing or disagreeing. We have to listen to understand in the same way we want to be understood. Courage and Power from Pain, an interview with Viola Davis. I want to end this chapter with an interview that I did with Viola Davis. You may know Viola from her performances in The Help, How to Get Away with Murder, and Fences, for which she won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. She is the first Black actor to win the Triple Crown of Acting, the Emmy, Tony, and Oscar. In 2017, she was listed by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Viola's story exemplifies the power of courage in the face of pain, vulnerability in the face of fear, and how living and loving close up leads to true belonging. When I asked Viola to tell me about the beginning of her journey into true belonging, she told me, I spent the first three quarters of my life feeling like a square peg in a round hole. I did not physically fit in. I lived in an Irish Catholic area of Rhode Island, white girls with long blonde hair. I was a kinky-haired girl with dark skin who spoke different. I wasn't pretty. I carried the trauma of growing up in abject poverty, the daughter of a violent alcoholic. I was a bedwetter until I was 12 or 13. I smelled. Teachers complained about the smell and sent me to the nurse's office. I was wrong. This was my beginning. My language for belonging was about survival. Can I take a hot shower? Is there food today? Will my dad kill my mom? Will there be rats in the house? I had no tools. I carried this trauma, fear, anxiety, and the inability to speak up for myself into my adult life. All of it was deeply rooted in shame. I spent all of my energy hiding and keeping the brutality of my life secret. I carried this dysfunction with me into my adult life. Then I asked Viola to tell me about taking her first steps into her wilderness. She said, I knew I was afraid of confrontation, but it wasn't until I started doing therapy that I realized why the anxiety made speaking up almost impossible. I had an experience where I should have confronted someone who was doing something horrible to me. What I realized was, in that moment, I flashed back to my 14-year-old self. I was holding my baby sister and my father was stabbing my mother in the neck with a pencil. I shouted, "Stop it! Give me that pencil!" He did it. My father stopped and handed me the pencil. I was a child who was forced to confront an adult. I had to take the power position before I should have needed to and before I was ready. I paid for it in fear. Viola is someone who's made the transition from fear of the wilderness to braving the wilderness to becoming the wilderness. I wanted to know how that happened. Viola said, At 38, things changed. I didn't jump out of bed one morning and everything was perfect. I've always known I was a strong woman, but I wanted fast food joy. Quick, easy joy, more tools and tricks. I also could still fall back into not enough, not pretty enough, not thin enough, not good enough. One day, my therapist asked me a pivotal question. What if nothing changes? Your looks, your weight, your success. Would you be okay? For the first time, I thought, you know what? Yes, I would. I really would. This is when I realized that the past was not going to define me. I also got married to an amazing man who really saw me. He was my gift for working so hard on myself. He was kind, and I was finally vulnerable and open to that. I asked Viola, when you belong to yourself, there is always going to be criticism. What's your experience with that? She replied, acting culture can be brutal. The notes can simply say, not attractive enough, too old, too dark-skinned, not skinny enough. They tell you to develop a thick skin so things won't get to you. What they don't tell you is that your thick skin will keep everything from getting out too. Love, intimacy, vulnerability. I don't want that. Thick skin doesn't work anymore. I want to be transparent and translucent. For that to work, I won't own other people's shortcomings and criticisms. I won't put what you say about me on my load. I'm not sure that there's a more poignant example of someone who was able to recognize her pain, own her story, and write a new ending that includes transforming her pain into compassion for others. Viola told me, I held my dad's hand as he died. He died of pancreatic cancer. We had healed our relationship. We loved each other very much. When my sister and I sat with him, we learned that he hated his work for his entire life. For decades, he groomed horses at a racetrack. We never knew he hated it. He had a second-grade education. He also worked as a janitor. We never knew that's how he felt. It was devastating for us to think about the pain he endured his entire life. Viola said, there's an unspoken message that the only stories worth telling are the stories that end up in history books. This is not true. Every story matters. My father's story matters. We are all worthy of telling our stories and having them heard. We all need to be seen and honored in the same way that we all need to breathe. I think Viola Davis is the wilderness. I asked her if true belonging took the shape of a practice for her. She said, yes. Today I live by a few simple rules. Number one, I'm doing the best I can. Number two, I will allow myself to be seen. Number three, I apply the advice an acting coach gave me to all aspects of my life. Go further. Don't be afraid. Put it all out there. Don't leave anything on the floor. And number four, I will not be a mystery to my daughter. She will know me, and I will share my stories with her. The stories of failure, shame, and accomplishment. She will know she's not alone in that wilderness. Viola ended our interview with these four sentences. This is who I am. This is where I'm from. This is my mess. This is what it means to belong to myself. Chapter 5. Speak truth to bullshit. Be civil. Someone who lies and someone who tells the truth are playing on opposite sides, so to speak, in the same game. Each responds to the facts as he understands them, although the response of the one is guided by the authority of the truth, while the response of the other defies that authority and refuses to meet its demands. The bullshitter ignores these demands altogether. He does not reject the authority of the truth as the liar does and oppose himself to it. He pays no attention to it at all. By virtue of this, bullshit is a greater enemy of the truth than lies are. Harry G. Frankfurt. I'm grateful that Carl Jung reminds us that the paradox is one of our most valuable spiritual possessions, because without that reminder, I'd probably just feel pissed off about this specific true belonging practice. I love the idea of speaking truth to bullshit, and I believe in civility. I just think it's really hard to combine the two. In this chapter, we're going to dig into what drives BS, what form it often takes, and how we stay civil when we're knee-deep in it. Bullshit. Harry Frankfurt is a professor emeritus of philosophy at Princeton University. He spent his career teaching at Yale, Rockefeller, and Ohio State. In 2005, he published On Bullshit. It's a very small book about the nature of BS, how it's different from lying, and why we're all compelled to bullshit on occasion. I was captivated by 3 points that Frankfurt makes in his book, and how those points accurately reflect what I found from the research participants when they talked about their struggles to maintain their authenticity and integrity when engaging in debates and discussions driven by emotion rather than shared understanding of facts. The first insight is the difference between lying and bullshitting that's explained in the quote that opens this chapter. It's helpful to think of lying as a defiance of the truth and bullshitting as a wholesale dismissal of the truth. Second, it's advantageous to recognize how often we rely on bullshitting when we feel compelled to talk about things we don't understand. Frankfurt explains how the widespread conviction that many of us share about needing to comment or weigh in on every single issue around the globe leads to increased levels of BS. It's crazy to me that so many of us feel we need to have fact-based opinions on everything from what's happening in Sudan and Vietnam to the effects of climate change in the Netherlands and immigration policy in California. I'm guilty too. I can't remember a time in the last year when someone asked me about an issue and I didn't weigh in with an opinion. Even if I didn't know enough about it to be insightful or even conversational, I would lean into ideological debates based on what I guessed my people think about it. I also can't remember a time over the past year when I asked someone about an issue and had a person reply, "I actually don't know much about what's happening there. Tell me about it." We don't even bother being curious anymore because somewhere, someone on our side has a position. In a fitting-in culture, at home, at work, or in our larger community, curiosity is seen as weakness, and asking questions equates to antagonism rather than being valued as learning. Last, Frankfurt argues that the contemporary spread of bullshit also has a deeper source. Our being skeptical and denying that we can ever know the truth of how things truly are. He argues that when we give up on believing that there are actual truths that can be known and shared observable knowledge, we give up on the notion of objective inquiry. It's like we just collectively shrug our shoulders and say, "Well, whatever. It's too hard to get to the truth, so if I say it's true, that's good enough." Frankfurt's astute observation of where that leads us feels prophetic in 2017. He argues that once we decide that it makes no sense to try to be true to the facts, we simply resort to being true to ourselves. This, to me, is the birthplace of one of the great bullshit problems of our time, the "you're either with us or against us" argument. If you're not with me, then you're my enemy. As I briefly touched on earlier, one of the biggest drivers of the sorting that's happening today is the proliferation of the belief that you're either with us or against us. It's an emotional line that we hear everyone, from politicians to movie heroes and villains, invoke on a regular basis. It's one of the most effective political sorters, and 95% of the time, it's an emotional and passionate rendering of bullshit, well-intentioned or not. Benito Mussolini relied heavily on the line, "O con noi, o contro di noi," you're either with us or against us. In the weeks following 9/11, both George W. Bush and Hillary Clinton told the world's citizens that they were either with us in the fight against terrorism or against us. Bush took it even further by saying, "Every nation and every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists." And it's in our stories, too. In Star Wars, Revenge of the Sith, Darth Vader says to Obi-Wan Kenobi, "If you're not with me, then you are my enemy." Normally, we use the "with me or against me" during times of significant emotional stress. Our intentions may not be to manipulate, but to force the point that we're in a situation where neutrality is dangerous. I actually agree with this point. One of my favorite live-by quotes is from Elie Wiesel. "We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. The problem is that the emotional plea is often not based in facts and preys on our fears of not belonging or being seen as wrong or part of the problem. We need to question how the sides are defined. Are these really the only two options? Is this the accurate framing for this debate, or is this bullshit? In philosophy, you're either with us or against us is considered a false dichotomy or false dilemma. It's a move to force people to take sides. If other alternatives exist, and they almost always do, then that statement is factually wrong. It's turning an emotion-driven approach into weaponized belonging. And it always benefits the person throwing down the gauntlet and brandishing those forced false choices. The ability to think past either-or situations is the foundation of critical thinking, but still it requires courage. Getting curious and asking questions happens outside our bunkers of certainty. For most of us, even if the with us or against us mandate sounds a little like oversimplified BS, it still feels easier and safer to pick a side. The argument is set up in a way that there's only one real option. If we stay quiet, we're automatically demonized as the other. The only true option is to refuse to accept the terms of the argument by challenging the framing of the debate. But make no mistake, this is opting for the wilderness. Why? Because the argument is set up to silence dissent and draw lines in the sand that squelch debate, discussion, and questions, the very processes that we know lead to effective problem solving. Our silence, however, comes at a very high individual and collective cost. Individually, we pay with our integrity. Collectively, we pay with divisiveness, and even worse, we bypass effective problem solving. Answers that have the force of emotion behind them, but are not based in fact, rarely provide strategic and effective solutions to nuanced problems. We normally don't set up false dilemmas because we're intentionally bullshitting. We often rely on this device when we're working from a place of fear, acute emotion, and a lack of knowledge. Unfortunately, fear, acute emotion, and lack of knowledge also provide the perfect setup for uncivil behavior. This is why the bullshit incivility cycle can become endless. Civility. It's easier to stay civil when we're combating lying than it is when we're speaking truth to bullshit. When we're bullshitting, we aren't interested in the truth as a shared starting point. This makes arguing slippery, and it makes us more susceptible to mirroring the BS behavior, which is, the truth doesn't matter, what I think matters. It's helpful to keep in mind Alberto Brandolini's bullshit asymmetry principle, or what's become known as Brandolini's law. The amount of energy needed to refute bullshit is an order of magnitude bigger than to produce it. Sometimes calling out BS is unnecessary because there's an expectation of embellishment, like an overly polite compliment or, in the case of my Texan family, a tall tale of walking uphill to school, both ways, in the snow, pulling a donkey. But when the stakes are high and we need to speak truth to bullshit, I've seen two practices that increase effectiveness. First, approach bullshitting with generosity when possible. Don't assume that people know better and they're just being malicious or mean-spirited. In highly charged discussions, we can feel shame about not having an informed opinion, and these feelings of not enough can lead us to bullshitting our way through a conversation. We can also believe we're responding from real data and have no idea that there's nothing to back up what we're saying. Additionally, we can get so caught up in our own pain and fear that truth, in fact, plays second fiddle to emotional pleas for understanding or agreement. Generosity, empathy, and curiosity. Where did you read this or hear this? Can go a long way in our efforts to question what we're hearing and introduce fact. The second practice is civility. I found a definition of civility from the Institute for Civility and Government that very closely reflects how the research participants talked about civility. The organization's co-founders, Cassandra Donkey and Thomas Spath, write, "Civility is claiming and caring for one's identity, needs, and beliefs without degrading someone else's in the process. Civility is about disagreeing without disrespect, seeking common ground as a starting point for dialogue about differences, listening past one's preconceptions, and teaching others to do the same. Civility is the hard work of staying present, even with those with whom we have deep-rooted and fierce disagreements. It is political in the sense that it is a necessary prerequisite for civic action. But it is political, too, in the sense that it is about negotiating interpersonal power such that everyone's voice is heard and nobody's is ignored. Holding what we're exploring about bullshit, false dichotomies, and civility in our heads, let's take a look at two real stories. The first is a story about an experience when I was thrown into a with-us-or-against-us situation around a very controversial issue and had to fight to stay civil in the midst of BS. The second is a story of how I fell prey to my own BS and unknowingly dropped my team into the you're-either-with-me-or-against-me construct. What I learned from both of these experiences changed me. Battery-operated socks. I knew exactly what I wanted for my 14th birthday. No more Bobby Brooks sweaters, pet rocks, Leif Garrett posters, or toe socks. I was ready for some serious teenage gifts. My list included my own set of Clairol hot rollers, the ones with the plastic cover that snapped into the travel handle, Some Girls by the Rolling Stones. I had lent mine to a friend and her older brother sold it for beer. A pair of Gloria Vanderbilt jeans and a pair of Candy's shoes, those rockin' slide-on high heels that all the cool girls were wearing. I got the hot rollers, a pair of Lee jeans, and the replacement Rolling Stones album. My parents suggested that I get a job if I wanted a pair of Gloria Vanderbilt or Jordache jeans, and that I find myself some new parents if I wanted to wear Candy's before I turned 20. Before I retreated to my room to blast Beast of Burden, my parents surprised me with another gift. I could tell by the box it wasn't the Candy's, but my dad's excitement was contagious, so I eagerly ripped into the gift. Battery-operated socks. Big, woolly, gray, battery-operated socks. I must have looked confused because my dad said, "Come on, sis, for the deer blind, so your feet don't get cold anymore." I felt bad. I knew instantly that I'd never need those socks, but I didn't know how to break the news to my dad. I was done hunting. In all of our trips, I had never shot a deer. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I could hold my own in a dove or quail hunt, but I wasn't ever going to shoot a deer. So for me, hunting trips were just long days in freezing blinds and cold nights in sleeping bags with all my cousins. I never went again, and I never used my socks, but today I realize how much hunting was a part of my life growing up. Even after I'd stopped going, I still felt the communal excitement and anticipation in our house when the various seasons would open. Those dates were part of the rhythm of our family, like birthdays or holidays. There were always family and friends visiting and feasts of amazing food. My dad was very serious about all things hunting. You could only shoot what was covered by your hunting license, and you absolutely could not shoot anything you didn't plan to eat. These were non-negotiable rules in my house, essentially etched into stone tablets. He had no patience for trophy hunting or the like. In turn, we were like the Bubba Gumps of venison. Venison steak, venison sausage, venison stew, venison jerky, venison burgers. There was nothing better than when the hunters came back from the hunting lease and 20 or 30 people would pack into our house or my aunt's house to process deer meat, make tamales, tell stories, and laugh. My dad is the youngest of six, and I have 24 first cousins. There were a lot of mouths to feed. Hunting and fishing were as practical and necessary as they were fun for most of us. We all had guns. We got BB guns when we were in second or third grade and hunting rifles by fifth grade, when most of us started hunting. Gun safety was no joke. In fact, we weren't allowed to shoot a gun that we couldn't take apart, clean, and put back together. When you grow up hunting, you have a very different understanding about the reality of guns. It's not a video game. You know and have felt exactly what they're capable of doing. For my dad and the people we hunted with, the sentiment around automatic weapons and the big guns that people treat like toys today was simple. You want to shoot those kind of guns? Great. Enlist and serve. Now that I'm a parent, I can look back and see that what was equally powerful was the combination of our family rules concerning hunting and guns, and that we weren't allowed to watch any violence on television. I couldn't see a PG movie until I was 15 years old. The idea of romanticizing violence was out of the question. We didn't have violent video games back then, but I can only imagine how my dad would have felt about them. I loved and was proud of this part of my family story. And, like most kids, I assumed that everyone who was raised in a hunting and gun culture was raised with the same rules. But as I got a little older, I realized that wasn't true. As laws governing gun ownership became more and more political and polarized, I became more skeptical of the gun lobby. I watched the NRA go from being an organization that I associated with safety programs, merit badges, and charity skeet tournaments to something I didn't recognize. Why were they positioning themselves as the people who represented families like ours, while not putting any limits or parameters around responsible gun ownership? Despite my beliefs, my family started supporting the gun lobby while many of my friends and colleagues began vilifying all gun ownership. I quickly realized that I'd have no ideological home or community on this issue. I didn't have the language of the wilderness to describe how alone I felt about this, but it definitely was and is the wild. Late last year, I was talking to a group of people at an event, and I mentioned that my father and I were looking forward to teaching my son how to shoot skeet. One woman looked horrified and said, "I'm very surprised to hear that you're a gun lover. You don't strike me as the NRA type." If you're hearing her comment as aggressive and pointed, then I'm communicating it accurately. There was contempt and disgust on her face. I replied, "I'm not sure what you mean by gun lover or the NRA type." She sat straight up in her chair. "If you're teaching your child how to shoot a gun, then I'm assuming that you support gun ownership and the NRA." There it was, the false dichotomy. If I support gun ownership, then I support the National Rifle Association. No way, I'm not buying it. Of all of the lobbying organizations I've studied over the past 20 years, not one of them has done a better job using fear and false dichotomies than the NRA. Today's NRA rhetoric employs the ominous "they" and forces "us versus them" language over and over. Allow anyone to buy any type of gun and ammunition, when and wherever they want, or they will break down your door, take away your guns, crush your freedom, kill everyone you love, and put an end to the American way. They are after us. They are coming. That's the biggest bunch of bullshit I've heard since someone told me, if you own a gun, any gun, you might as well be the one pulling the trigger in all of these terrible mass shootings. No and no. I took a deep, don't lose your shit breath, smiled, and said, "You're one for two on your assumptions. I do support responsible gun ownership. I do not in any way support the NRA, just because I support responsible gun ownership." She looked mad and confused. "But with all the school shootings, I don't understand why you don't support gun control." "Ugh, come on, sister. I absolutely do support common sense gun laws. I believe in background checks and waiting periods. I don't believe that it should be legal to sell automatic weapons, large magazines, or armor-piercing bullets. I don't believe in campus carry. I..." She was so angry at this point, she spit out, "You either support guns or you don't." Because I was already working on this book, I said the thing that I felt my entire life but was either too afraid to say or didn't have the words. I mustered up the most empathy I could and said, "I know that this is a hard and heartbreaking issue, but I don't think you're hearing me. I'm not going to participate in a debate where the issue is reduced to you either support guns or you don't. It's too important. If you want to have a longer conversation about it, I'm happy to do that. And I wouldn't be surprised if the same issues piss us off and scare us." She excused herself and stormed away. She probably hates me. The small group of people who were standing with us may hate me. You may hate me. Who knows? It's not always the happy ending from some movie, but I'll take it if it's real. Here's why the ending works for me. I knew exactly what I could have said in that moment to position myself as the darling of the group. I could have betrayed my actual beliefs and made myself the hero in a heartbeat. I could have avoided the confrontation entirely. You didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to know that everyone standing in that group preferred no guns or, at the very least, no uncomfortable conversation about guns. I also could have opted to stay quiet, or I could have lost my shit. But instead, I belonged to me. I did the best I could to debunk the either-or argument. I chose to be out in the open, away from the safety of the ideological bunker that room had become. And I was decent. I was respectful to her and to myself. I felt alone in the wilderness, but it was okay. I may not have been liked, and that didn't feel so great, but I was in my integrity. And the group may have felt betrayed by my answer or my willingness to get into a tough conversation, but still, and most important, I didn't betray myself. To know you can navigate the wilderness on your own, to know that you can stay true to your beliefs, trust yourself, and survive it. That is true belonging. Chief of Staff. Most people are surprised to learn that in addition to my research, I lead 4 companies and work with a team of about 25 people. There's Brave Leaders, Inc., The Daring Way, The Marble Jar Store, and our umbrella company, Brené Brown Education and Research Group. There's a team that manages my speaking events, another that runs The Daring Way, our training program for helping professionals, a team that coordinates all of our volunteer and pro bono work, a team that runs our store, leaders who oversee our social work intern program, a consumer experience team, researchers, a team that develops and produces digital content, and a core team that handles our mission and operations work. Our mission is making the world a braver place by doing work we love with people we care about in a way that's aligned with our values. Every time I walk into our offices, I wonder how I got so lucky as to have a team that believes deeply in our work and in one another. I spend most of my time with the Roundup team, which consists of Charles, our CFO, Murdoch, my manager, and Suzanne, our president and COO. A little over a year ago, I was so underwater with the pressures of writing, traveling to speak, teaching, trying to lead the day-to-day operations of these businesses, and researching, that the Roundup team called an emergency offsite meeting in Galveston to see if we could come up with a solution to what was clearly an untenable situation. I was cratering so fast that Steve took off work to join us for the day. He wanted to make sure that something was going to change, and he knew delegating and letting go were deep struggles for me. It felt like 5 minutes ago that I was a person with a book and a blog, and suddenly I was the CEO and president. It was too much, too fast, and I was lost. There were 12 of us, including the 4 members of the Roundup team in Galveston. We had 3 agenda items at our meeting. 1, make a comprehensive list of everything that I was doing so we could better understand what I could hand off to others. 2, develop a strategy that would keep me above water. And 3, put all of the ideas, plans, and strategies that lived in my head on paper so we could assess what was important and what was not. About 2 hours into our meeting, someone suggested that one solution to all of these problems might be bringing on someone to serve in a chief of staff role. Of course, when I hear chief of staff, all I can think of is Leo McGarry, President Bartlett's chief of staff on the West Wing. At first I laughed, but within minutes everyone was excited about the idea and I started to feel hopeful. Half an hour into the discussion, one of our team members volunteered to move into that position, and I felt more relief and excitement than I had felt in a year. I was even a little teary-eyed. I was fully leaning into this idea, and when I do that, the people around me normally take notice. I am a passionate and intense person, and despite my love of good humor and belly laughing until I cry, most people who know me well describe me as a pretty serious person. The first time I heard someone describe me as serious, it hurt my feelings. I'd always thought of myself as bubbly and whimsical, like Meg Ryan in French Kiss. When I finally reality-checked my personality dysmorphia with Steve, he confirmed, "Kind and funny, yes. Bubbly and whimsical, no. Serious, almost always." My team has shared the feedback with me that sometimes when I get passionate and intense about an idea, it's like being in a Brené wind tunnel. They say it's hard to stay standing, much less speak up. This chief of staff position felt like a lifesaver to me, and I was now its greatest champion. Cue the wind tunnel. I looked at the group and said, "This is going to change everything. I say we start right away, no time like the present." I spotted a smidgen of concern on the faces of the Roundup team, but I felt temporarily delivered from desperation, and it was such a welcome feeling that I didn't much care about the drop of reservation I saw. I drew a deep breath and said, "We either try this starting right now, or we pretend that everything will be different after today, even though we know it won't." The room was quiet for a few seconds. I flipped to a new page in my journal and wrote COS at the top and started numbering down the side of the page. This is where I'd start to list all of the responsibilities I could hand off to this new person so I could get some of my life back. When I looked up for a brief second, Suzanne had her hand in the air. I smiled because it seemed funny to me that she was raising her hand and not just talking. I looked at her and said, yes, Suzanne? Her face was red, but her eyes and voice were steady. I want to remind everyone in this room, especially the Roundup team, that we made a decision to never hire anyone or reassign positions in a group setting. We made a commitment to move slower and talk things through as a smaller team before we make decisions like this. My sense of hope and possibility immediately vanished. Steve would later tell me that he'd never seen someone so visibly deflate in his life. I just stared at Suzanne. My disappointment was quickly turning into anger. Before I could say a word, Suzanne said, "I don't think the options are making this decision right now or pretending that everything will be different after today when we know it won't. We will work on this until we fix it. But I believe in the commitment our team made to not make decisions under these circumstances." We called a break and I went into the bathroom and cried. I was so tired, so desperate for help and support. And after a 5-minute sob, deeply grateful to Suzanne. She was right. I hated giving up on the magic bullet, even though I knew it reeked of bullshit as it was happening. Desperate times call for desperate measures, and desperate measures are often fertilized with bullshit. Suzanne was waiting for me as I came out of the bathroom. I thanked her for being so brave, and she assured me that she knew the current situation was bad for me, bad for our work, bad for everyone, and needed to change. She promised that together we could find a new way of working. Suzanne still describes that moment as one of the hardest in our time together. For her, questioning my decision was the absolute wilderness. She felt alone, vulnerable, and scared. And truthfully, she was completely alone as she raised her hand in that meeting. From my perspective, it was the day I realized I could trust her with anything. I promoted Suzanne to president of Brené Brown Education and Research Group. Today, she runs the day-to-day operations of the businesses, and she kicks total ass. This experience is also when our team started to understand how important it is for us to build a culture that supports true belonging. If leaders really want people to show up, speak out, take chances, and innovate, we have to create cultures where people feel safe, where their belonging is not threatened by speaking out, and they are supported when they make the decision to brave the wilderness, stand alone, and speak truth to bullshit. It's easy to underestimate the importance of civility at work, but new research shows just how crippling incivility can be for teams and organizations. Christine Poreth, an associate professor of management at Georgetown University, writes, "Incivility can fracture a team, destroying collaboration, splintering members' sense of psychological safety, and hampering team effectiveness. Belittling and demeaning comments, insults, and other rude behavior can deflate confidence, sink trust, and erode helpfulness, even for those who aren't the target of these behaviors." She cites her own research and other studies that show how implementing civility standards and enforcing them leads to higher performing and better functioning teams. I had the opportunity to interview NFL coach Pete Carroll of the Seattle Seahawks for this research. When I asked him about the challenges of developing an organizational culture of true belonging, he offered what I believe is a profound insight into brave leadership. Coach Carroll said, "There's no question that it's easier to manage a fitting in culture. You set standards and rules. You lead by put up or shut up. But you miss real opportunities, especially helping your team members find their purpose. When you push a fitting in culture, you miss the opportunity to help people find their personal drive, what's coming from their hearts. Leading for true belonging is about creating a culture that celebrates uniqueness. What serves leaders best is understanding your players' best efforts. My job as a leader is to identify their unique gift or contribution. A strong leader pulls players toward a deep belief in themselves." Words as weapons. Sometimes civility takes the shape of respect and generosity. I recently taught an online course with Dr. Harriet Lerner on how to offer a true, heartfelt apology and how to accept one. It kicked my ass. I think we should broadcast these apologizing lessons over the airwaves of some Orwellian TV station so everyone in the country could learn these skills. We need them. As Harriet invited me to practice listening and apologizing without disclaimers and exceptions, I learned that when I'm armored up, I'd rather be right than connected and invested in my relationship. I want to win. I love being right. The need to be right is magnified when we feel we're in hostile territory and under attack. A cultural example of this is political correctness. The history of this concept is as wild and unruly as the conversations about it have become. At this point, the term is so loaded that I think it makes more sense to talk about inclusive language. Given what we know about dehumanizing, I believe inclusive language is critically important, absolutely worth the effort, and a function of civility. We often take sides when it comes to the big political debates around issues like sports team names and ignore the everyday instances that are equally diminishing. For example, let's say you've been diagnosed with anxiety and your child has attention deficit disorder. How would you feel if you overheard your doctor saying, "Yeah, I got my anxiety disorder coming in at 2, and then I'm going to see the ADD kid before I go home"? Proponents of inclusive language would say that you're not your diagnosis. You're a person with anxiety. It matters to all of us. No one wants to be reduced. But what's tough about the inclusive language movement is when people turn using the right language into a weapon to shame or belittle people. This came up over and over in the research. Even tools of civility can become weaponized if the intention is there. I'll share a couple of stories with you. First, there was a man in his late 20s who shared a story of driving from his home in Los Angeles to Newport Beach to visit his parents. He told me that during the morning drive, he made a commitment to be more patient and tolerant of his father. They had a long history of not getting along. The afternoon the man arrived, he was standing in the kitchen making small talk when he asked his father, "Hey, how are your new neighbors?" His father said, "We really like them. We've had them over for dinner a couple of times and we've become friends. They're cooking dinner for us next week. They're Oriental and she's going to make some special dumplings, so your mom is really looking forward to that." The young man told me that he ripped right into his father. "Oriental? Jesus, Dad, are you kidding? Racist much?" Before his father could even respond, he went back at him. "Oriental is so racist. Do you even know where they're from? There's no country called the Orient. Ugh, how embarrassing." He said that rather than engaging, his father stood in the kitchen with his head down. When his father finally looked up at his son, he was teary-eyed. "I'm sorry, son. I'm not sure what I've done or not done to make you so angry. I just can't do anything right. Nothing I do or say is good enough for you." There was total silence. Then his father said, "I'd stay and let you tell me what an asshole I am, but I'm taking the neighbor I supposedly hate to pick up her husband from cataract surgery. She doesn't drive and he took a cab this morning." During the interview, the man told me that he didn't know what to do or say, so he just walked away before his dad left the kitchen. The second story happened to me. I was teaching a half-day course on shame resilience. Yes, oh, the irony. And there were about 200 people in the audience. At the halfway mark of the day, we took a short break. I was going through my notes when a woman walked up to me and said, "I cannot tell you how much you hurt me this morning." I was stunned. Time started slowing down and I was falling into tunnel vision, my normal shame response. Before I could open my mouth, she said, "Your work has changed my life. It saved my marriage and shaped my children. I came here today because you're an important teacher in my life. Then 15 minutes after you start, I learned that you're an anti-Semite. I trusted you and you've proven to be a fraud." Shame, shitstorm of gigantic proportion. Nightmare come true. All I could eke out was, I don't understand. She said, "You said that you felt really gypped during your story." I still didn't get it. Again, I said, "I don't understand." She got louder. "Gypped, gypped, gypped. Don't you know? How do you think you spell gypped?" It was a weird question, but I was too far down the shame hole to say anything helpful like, "I can see you're really angry, let's talk about it." I paused for a second to sound out the word in my head and find a word remotely close that I could use as a spelling reference. The only thing that came to mind was Jif peanut butter, of course. J-I-P-P-E-D. She yelled, "No, nothing in the world is spelled J-I-P-P-E-D. It's spelled G-Y-P-P-E-D, like gypsy. It's an anti-Semitic term that degrades gypsies." I had no idea. My mind was scrambling. Was I in one of those nightmare scenarios where the truth was spilling out and I couldn't control it? Did I really hate gypsies? Was I deep undercover as a politically correct social worker that really harbored hateful feelings about gypsies? No. I just didn't know. I had no idea. I guess the look on my face told her that I wasn't lying because she said, "Oh my God, you didn't know. You didn't do that on purpose, did you?" At this point, I was in tears. "I'm so sorry. I did not know. I apologize," I explained. She hugged me and we talked about it for a few minutes. When everyone came back, I explained what I had learned and apologized to the group for using that language. But honestly, I never recovered that afternoon. For the man visiting his father, it would have been just as easy to say, "You know, Dad, people are not using the term Oriental any longer. Language is changing fast. I thought I'd let you know." If he wanted to be really empathic, he could have said something like, "I'm learning every day too." If my work really meant that much to the woman at the conference, she could have approached me with a more generous assumption. She could have said, "I don't know if you know this, but gypped is a derogatory word based on a hurtful stereotype of gypsies." I would have been grateful instead of ashamed. I don't know about you, but I want to know if I'm saying something that's hurtful. I want to be kind and thoughtful with my words because I'm keenly aware of how much they matter. Will it be awkward? Yes. Is it frustrating to have to teach people why their words are hurtful to you? Yes. Does talking about these issues require a venture into the wilderness? Yes. But it also requires that we stay vulnerable, and that's hard to do when we're turning our words into weapons. Braving. Speaking truth to bullshit and practicing civility start with knowing ourselves and knowing the behaviors and issues that both push us into our own BS or get in the way of being civil. If we go back to braving in our trust checklist, these situations require a keen eye on the following. 1. Boundaries. What's okay in a discussion and what's not? How do you set a boundary when you realize you're knee-deep in BS? 2. Reliability. Bullshitting is the abandonment of reliability. It's hard to trust or be trusted when we BS too often. 3. Accountability. How do we hold ourselves and others accountable for less BS and more honest debate, less offloading of emotion and more civility? 4. Vault. Civility honors confidentiality. BS ignores truth and opens the door to violations of confidentiality. 5. Integrity. How do we stay in our integrity when confronted with BS? And how do we stop in the midst of our own emotional moment to say, "You know what? I'm not sure this conversation is productive," or "I need to learn more about this issue." 6. Non-judgment. How do we state of judgment toward ourselves when the right thing to do is to say, "I actually don't know much about this. Tell me what you know and why it's important to you." How do we not go into winner-loser mode and instead see an opportunity for connection when someone says to us, "I don't know anything about that issue"? 7. Generosity. What's the most generous assumption we can make about the people around us? What boundaries have to be in place for us to be kinder and more tolerant? I know the practice of speaking truth to bullshit while being civil feels like a paradox, but both are profoundly important parts of true belonging. Carl Jung wrote, "Only the paradox comes anywhere near to comprehending the fullness of life." I agree, and I believe that we are complex beings who wake up every day and fight against being labeled and diminished with stereotypes and characterizations that don't reflect our fullness. Yet when we don't risk standing on our own and speaking out, when the options laid before us force us into the very categories we resist, we perpetuate our own disconnection and loneliness. When we are willing to risk venturing into the wilderness and even becoming our own wilderness, we feel the deepest connection to our true self and to what matters the most. Chapter 6. Hold Hands with Strangers. We're in a spiritual crisis, and the key to building a true belonging practice is maintaining our belief in inextricable human connection. That connection, the spirit that flows between us and every other human being in the world, is not something that can be broken. However, our belief in that connection is constantly tested and repeatedly severed. When our belief that there's something greater than us, something rooted in love and compassion, breaks, we are more likely to retreat to our bunkers, to hate from afar, to tolerate bullshit, to dehumanize others, and, ironically, to stay out of the wilderness. It's counterintuitive, but our belief in inextricable human connection is one of our most renewable sources of courage in the wilderness. I can stand up for what I believe is right when I know that, regardless of the pushback and criticism, I'm connected to myself and others in a way that can't be severed. When we don't believe in an unbreakable connection, the isolation of the wilderness is too daunting, so we stay in our factions and our echo chambers. As hard as things are in the world right now, it's not just our polarizing culture that weakens our belief in inextricable human connection and strains our spiritual commitment to one another. It's also navigating the demands of our everyday lives. People are wonderful, and they can be hard. My favorite Peanuts cartoon is Linus crying, "I love mankind. It's people I can't stand." Everyday life can be incredibly hard, and the people around us can push us to the very edge of our nerves and our civility. Cover It All in Leather. I love Pema Chodron's Lousy World teaching on this topic. In it, Chodron uses the lessons of the Indian Buddhist monk Shantideva to make a very powerful analogy about moving through the world constantly pissed off and disappointed. Chodron's lesson is from a video, so I transcribed the video and edited her talk into something that I can read for you. Brace yourself. It's both familiar and uncomfortably true. Chodron starts, "This lousy world. These lousy people, this lousy government, this lousy everything. Lousy weather, lousy blah, blah, blah. We're pissed off. It's too hot in here. It's too cold. I don't like the smell. The person in front of me is too tall, and the person next to me is too fat. That person is wearing perfume, and I'm allergic to it. And just, ugh." She says, "It's like being barefooted and walking across blazing hot sand or across cut glass or in a field with thorns. Your feet are bare and you say, this is just too hard. It's really hurting. It's terrible. It's too sharp. It's too painful. It's too hot. But you have a great idea. You're just going to cover everywhere you go with leather. And then it won't hurt your feet anymore." Spreading leather everywhere you go so you can cover the pain is like saying, "I'm going to get rid of her and get rid of him. I'm going to get the temperature right, and I'm going to ban perfume in the world, and then there will be nothing that bothers me anywhere. I'm going to get rid of everything, including mosquitoes that bother me, anywhere in the world, and then I will be a happy, content person." Chodron pauses. We're laughing, but it's what we all do. That is how we approach things. We think, if we could just get rid of everything or cover it with leather, our pain would go away. Well, sure, because then it wouldn't be cutting our feet anymore. It's just logical, right? But it doesn't make any sense, really. Shantideva said, "But if you simply wrap the leather around your feet." In other words, if you put on shoes, then you could walk across the boiling sand and the cut glass and the thorns, and it wouldn't bother you. So the analogy is, if you work with your mind instead of trying to change everything on the outside, that's how your temper will cool down. I just love this work by Chodron. So I think if we love the idea of humankind, but people in general are constantly on our nerves, and we can't cover everything that we don't like in leather, the question is, how do we cultivate and grow our belief in inextricable human connection internally? The answer that emerged from my research shocked me. Show up for collective moments of joy and pain so we can actually bear witness to inextricable human connection. Women and men with the strongest true belonging practices maintain their belief in inextricable connection by engaging in moments of joy and pain with strangers. In simpler terms, we have to catch some of that lightning in a bottle. We have to catch enough glimpses of people connecting to one another and having fun together that we believe it's true and possible for all of us. Although catching these glimpses of human connection was a foreign research concept to me, I had more fun digging into what this means and what it looks like than I've had with almost any other work I've done in my career. And as I got my head around what this practice looks like in real life, I learned that I'm actually pretty good at it. Before this work, I didn't know why I put so much value on these collective moments. Why I intentionally go to a church where I can break bread, pass the peace, and sing with people who believe differently than I do, and people who I often want to punch in the arm. Why I cried the first time I took my kids to see U2 in concert, and why they both reached out and held my hand during my favorite songs. Why the University of Texas fight song always makes me cheer and throw up my hook'em sign. Or why I've taught my kids that attending funerals is critically important, and when you're there, you show up. You take part, every song, every prayer, even if it's in a language you don't understand or a faith that you don't practice. I always knew these moments were important to me. I knew they were connected to my spiritual well-being and allowed me to stay in love with humanity while doing research that can be devastating and hard. I just didn't know why. Now I do. Let's explore what experiences of collective joy and pain look like. You'll never walk alone. A couple of years ago, I clicked on a tweet by TED owner and curator Chris Anderson that read, "When football equals religion, spine-tingling Aussie rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone." The link took me to a YouTube video of 95,000 Australian fans of the Liverpool Football Club gathered at the Melbourne Cricket Ground for a soccer match. For 2 minutes, I watched a stadium of Liverpool fans sway in unison as they sang the club's famous anthem, red scarves held high over their heads, and tears streaming down many of their faces. I was surprised to find myself fighting back my own tears. And based on the video's 6 million views, you can be sure that it wasn't just Liverpool fans or even soccer fans that found themselves misty-eyed and covered in goosebumps. In fact, the first comment on YouTube was from a user with the handle Manchester United Fan Prez, Manchester being one of Liverpool's greatest rivals. The comment simply read, all caps, respect. Regardless of which team we're rooting for, the power of collective joy can transcend that division. The next day, Steve and I made a commitment to make more time for football games, of the Texas variety, live music, and plays. In the age of YouTube, I'd started to forget what those moments felt like, and being there in person is so much more powerful. Colin Baton Rouge. If you're within 10 years on either side of my age and you grew up in Texas, I know two names will bring a smile to your face and open up a floodgate of memories. George Strait, Garth Brooks. When my sisters, Ashley and Barrett, and I reminisce about growing up, our ex-boyfriends, our best moments, our worst moments, jeans that were so tight you had to use pliers to pull them up, and hair that reached for the sky, Garth Brooks and George Strait provide the soundtrack. Every story has a song, and every song has a story. Last year, Steve, Ashley, Barrett, Frankie, Barrett's husband, and I met our dear friends Rondell and Miles in San Antonio to see Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood in concert. It was extra fun because Rondell had worked with Garth for years, so we got to meet Garth and Trisha before the concert. They're as warm and down home as you'd imagine. The concert was amazing. We knew the words to every song. And anyone who's ever seen Garth in concert will tell you he is one hell of a showman. The best moment for us was when he sang our collective favorite, Colin Baton Rouge. We didn't know it at the time, but Rondell had videotaped us through the entire thing. I still cry when I watch it. 3 or 4 months later, I was in the car with my sisters and my nieces when I turned to Barrett and said, "Let's listen to Baton Rouge." Gabby, Barrett's six-year-old daughter, said, "No, I want to listen to number one. I want to listen to the one that we sing every day." Barrett laughed. Baton Rouge is number one. My sisters and I confessed we had all been listening to that song on repeat since the concert. All three of us had owned the CD that included that song before the concert, but only after that moment of joy and connection did we start listening to it 3 times a day, every day. So what was happening? That song took us back to a moment. If you watch it on Rondell's video, it's a moment you can only describe as pure love. Love for music, for our history together, and for one another. All three of us are hugging, holding hands, and sing-screaming the words at the top of our lungs. "Operator, won't you put me on through? I gotta send my love down to Baton Rouge." Wands up. It's no secret that I'm a Harry Potter fan. My daughter, Ellen, grew up with the books, and we were always among the first in line for book and movie releases. In 2009, we attended opening night for Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. There were plenty of Gryffindor scarves, forehead scars that were etched out of eyeliner, and t-shirts that read, "Keep calm and carry a wand." Sadly, toward the end of the film, our wise guide and faithful leader, Dumbledore, is killed. There's a scene where Harry is bent over his body weeping. Dumbledore was the headmaster of Hogwarts School and a father figure, mentor, and protector to Harry. Even if you've never read the books or seen the movies, you know the scene. A young protagonist losing his or her parent figure and guide. It's an essential element in the arc of many great stories and a pivotal part of what Joseph Campbell called the hero's journey. As a crowd of students and professors gathers around Dumbledore's body, an evil face appears in the dark sky. It is the face of Voldemort, the person responsible for Dumbledore's death. As Harry places a hand on Dumbledore's chest and continues to weep, Dumbledore's dearest friend and fellow teacher, Professor McGonagall, played brilliantly by Dame Maggie Smith, raises her wand to the sky. From the tip of the wand comes a single burst of light. One by one, each student and teacher raises his or her wand to create a constellation of light that overcomes the dark and menacing sky. At that moment, in a movie theater in Houston, a universe away from Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, I looked around to find that 200 strangers, most of them with tears on their cheeks, had their hands in the air, pointing their imaginary wands to the sky. Why? Because we believe in the light. Yes, we know Harry Potter is not real. But we know that collective light is real and powerful. And in the face of hatred and bigotry and cruelty,